I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a cold, rainy fall day here in the mountains of Utah. A bit of housekeeping. The Kickstarter for my new Glass Immortals novella, Montego, is now live. It tells the story of our titular character's first arrival in the capital of the Osan Empire and his early relationship with Dimir and Kizzy. It's a must-have for fans of In the Shadow of Lightning, or a good low-key entrance into the universe. Follow the link in the show notes, or on my social media to buy your copy. Now, on with the show! My guest this week is epic fantasy author Nicholas Eames. Nick is known for his breakout Kings of the Wild and its sequel, The Bloody Rose. We chat about his forthcoming third book and the themes of the series, as well as our habits as writers, getting bogged down in details, leaning into the fantastical, and the hooks that bring the reader along with the ride. We also discuss eating out, our mutual love of video games, and music and the celebrity of music. Enjoy my conversation with Nicholas Eames. Hey man, so what games have you been playing lately? I was curious about that.
Oh my god, I was about to ask you the same thing. Well, lately I kind of went back and finished this old school game called Trails in the Sky. Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't.
There's a series called basically the Trails series. There is, I want to say, like nine or more in the series right now, maybe more. And they're the first three are called Trails in the Sky, first, second, and third chapter. And then there's two other ones that never got localized in North America, but are I think they just maybe did this summer. And then Trails of Cold Steel, which is a bit more relevant or like modern and popular. And I think there's four of them right now. And they all look like really good games, but when you look like where should you start, every person is like, you have to start at the beginning or there's no point.
Yeah.
So the early games are from like, I want to say 2004 or something like that. You know, they do feel pretty dated now, but they're good. There's a hell of a lot of reading. And the first game is often called a 40-hour prologue because it just kind of like sets up what comes later. But it's pretty good for a prologue. It definitely dragged at some points, but I'm glad I got it done. And, you know, eventually I'll do the second one and the third one and maybe work my way over the course of my life through all these games.
What style of games are they?
It's turn-based RPG.
Okay.
Like, you know, yeah, Japanese RPG. And then when I finished that, I've been halfway through Xenoblade Chronicles on my Switch for a long time. So I went back to that. I play just an absolute shit ton of Total War all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been playing a lot of that, Warhammer Total War. And also Yakuza 0. Which, have you ever heard of the Yakuza games at all?
I think I might actually own them all, but I don't think I've ever played them.
Yeah, so they're not normally my cup of tea, and there's something that just went right, like, I just went right past me, because I'm not usually hugely into, like, gangster-related stuff normally, and there is 7 Yakuza games, and I think multiple spinoffs, and then they released technically the 7th in the mainline series, which is called Yakuza Like a Dragon. And it starts with a whole new character, a whole new story, because the other ones are previously like a saga with the one character. And then there was like a prequel game. Anyways, Yakuza Like a Dragon is brand new character, same world. And instead of like a beat-em-up action style game, it is a full-fledged JRPG style with a main character who's kicked out of the Yakuza and like he's obsessed with Dragon Quest and those kind of games.
Yeah.
So he imagines life like that. So you meet people on the street and they're just these absurd like Dragon Quest type characters. And you play it turn-based combat. And it was an unbelievably good game. And it kind of got me into the series, which is so unique and so wacky and so unbelievably dramatic.
Huh.
So I went back and then, you know, whenever I look up a list of like, what is the greatest Yakuza game? Like a Dragon is almost always number 2. And this Yakuza 0, which is the prequel game, is pretty much always number one. So I picked it up and I'm playing through it now, and it is really good. It's not normally my kind of style, because it's like, you know, the fighting is like not button mashing, because there's a bit more complexity to it than that. But yeah. The storylines are just so good, and the quests are so good, and yeah, it is wacky as hell. Like, you've never seen anything like it, I don't think, unless you've played these games.
Oh, that's cool.
They're truly, truly unique. Yeah.
I feel like I missed the boat on JRPGs.
Oh, really?
Because I had noticed that you is really seem to enjoy JRPGs. And I have a lot of friends who played a lot of them. And I feel like for a lot of people kind of my age, like the gateway drug was like Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
And I've never played a Final Fantasy game. Like, I'm not 100% sure why. Maybe it's because I was more of a computer game kid than I was a console kid.
Yeah.
But like, I it does feel like kind of like a little bit of like a hole in my gaming.
Yeah, it's something you'd like. I mean, they are really good, and there's something to be said. They have a great quality to them that like Western RPGs don't necessarily have, and Western RPGs have a quality to them that the Japanese ones I don't think have. The Western ones tend to have a bit more grounded stories and characters. Obviously they appeal, like the main characters are meant to appeal to like Western audiences, because like every Final Fantasy main character looks like they've got the haircut of, to us, it looks like a 50-year-old woman named Blanche.
Yeah.
You know, but it's on like a young teenage boy. Yeah, I don't know. They're all, but in the end of every Japanese RPG, they're just really epic compared to Western ones, because you always like, you're a band of misfit adventurers that eventually fight God, you know.
Yeah.
So there's no effing around. In Western RPGs, you're a bit more kind of like grounded usually.
Right.
They both have their strengths, but I'm also like you, I think a huge like strategy computer tactical game lover as well.
That definitely was like where my love of gaming came from, like as a kid. Because I remember watching my brothers play Dune 2 and Warcraft Orcs and Humans.
Yeah.
And I'd watch them play. And then I probably spent a good year or two of my very young childhood only getting to watch them. And I finally started kind of getting computer time myself, right?
Yeah.
And playing those games. And so, yeah, strategy, computer games, strategy, RTS, the old school RTS.
Yeah, I think Age of Empires was my first, like, computer game obsession.
Yeah.
Back when I didn't have my own computer, so I would, like, make friends with people, you know, that had computers in Age of Empires and be like, cool, can I sleep over? Oh, you're going to sleep? Cool, I'll just jump on here for the next 8 hours.
Oh, man, I definitely had a friend, one of my best friends, his family, they had a family computer that was a good, way better than the computers that we had in my house. And his parents always bought them the games to play. And I always, like, looking back, I feel slightly embarrassed, because I remember, like, we hung out all the time. I was there constantly. And whenever I got even 5 seconds alone, like, I would bolt to their computer and play something on it.
Yeah.
Some game that they had that I didn't have, and, you know, to an embarrassing quality.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think to those of us who, like, you know, we realize now how much we love video games and what a huge inspiration and part of our lives they are, you know, those are the early signs of, like, you're going to love this thing. And when you have such limited access to it, you know, at a time when really everyone had pretty limited access to it compared to nowadays.
But
what about like Baldur's Gate? Did you ever play those games at all?
I played one of the Baldur's Gates through, and I don't even remember which one it was. It was for, I want to say PlayStation 2, maybe.
Okay.
And I have a very distinctive memory of there being we had a long winter break because of a big snowstorm. And I went over to a friend's house and we just ordered pizza almost every single day and played this game, and I don't remember which one it was, but I never got into, like, I wasn't like a religious, like I play all of the Baldur's Gate games, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It was just a game he happened to have, and we played it together.
But was it like a hack and slash kind of game, or was it like top down isometric tactical RPG?
It was a hack and slash. It was like a top down hack and slash. Like,
yeah, that would, I would, I mean, obviously some people may disagree, but I would not technically consider that a Baldur's Gate game.
Really?
That's more like a kind of a money making offshoot almost. Baldur's Gate, like, pretty much, no, it didn't like invent the whole top-down isometric RPG, but it certainly, you know, perfected it at that time. So all the games now, like Torment, I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I've heard of it. I haven't played it. I remember Neverwinter Nights was one that I remember trying to get into, and it went a little over my head. I don't even remember what age I would have been at the time.
Yeah.
But it was like a little too involved for kind of like where I was at gaming-wise.
Yeah. Well, do you play Total War at all?
I have played a lot of Total War. Not for a few years now, but let's see. I started off with probably the original Rome. Tons and tons of hours into that one. I played Rome 2. I played Empires. I played Medieval 1 and 2. Yeah, so the answer is yes. I think I've only played a few hours of the Warhammer one. It just, because I'm not like a Warhammer like junkie, like,
yeah.
And so when I started playing it, I was like, this is a little too much for me to get into. Mm-hmm. Like, to learn the lore and learn how every unit like is different, because you kind of have to, you know, when you're playing a game that, like, when you're playing like Rome, like Rome Total War, or even more better for me, Medieval Total War.
Yeah.
Like, every unit, I had a reasonably good understanding of what that unit would do without even having to look at their stats.
Yeah. You're like, I know what skirmishers do.
Right. You know what everybody does. And so when there's that like extra barrier of like, oh, I'm going to have to learn every single unit for a very complicated like war game.
Yeah. Fair.
And I don't like that anymore.
I mean, in Warhammer, because now they're three games deep. They meant to be a trilogy, and they've got it so that now all three games are combined into one.
Really?
So there's ultimately, yeah, you have to own all three games for that to work, but all three games in one. So it's about 86 separate like leaders that you choose from, each their own faction. Like, and they belong to the larger faction. Like, say there's, you know, six dwarf factions, whatnot.
Yeah.
But almost every one of them play differently than the other. meant the same units, but they all have a faction, like a thing that plays differently. It is so good. I mean, obviously I'm a huge fan of historical ones as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've always just wanted, even playing like Rome, I was like, oh, what would a fantasy, you know, war or total war game be like? And I don't know anything about Warhammer outside of this game myself. But yeah, turns out a fantasy total war is pretty goddamn good.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you ever as a writer, do you ever like look at a game and kind of go through that kind of daydream process of like, oh man, I could totally work on a game. I could develop something that would be playable and fun for people. I mean, and then, you know, at least if you're me, and then you realize, oh, there's so much more going on in a game development that I don't have any knowledge of. But I always wonder if other writers have that thing, you know, once every month or so, where they're like, I should work on a game.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I also think like sometimes, you know, there's like this technology out now on Steam and on like all the consoles where you can like kind of develop your own 8-bit game.
Yeah.
Or pixelated game. And I always think, oh, I wonder if I have a friend who would be into the, you know, the actual making of it enough, could we make a good one, you know, and something like that. And that's probably something I would love to do. But yeah, I do think about video game writing a lot, because it's something, to be honest, that I would actually love to do as a career as well. I was fortunate enough right before COVID to work on a game for a little bit. I got asked by this company to be a kind of a freelance writer and did a little bit of it. So it was a pretty cool experience to just learn, you know, the ropes a bit more about, like, you know, structuring narrative within, you know, gameplay elements. Yeah. And it was pretty interesting. And I'm about halfway through your podcast, with the video game writer, which is a really, really informative one as well. So,
well, and I'm fascinated by that kind of thing, right? Because like you and I do long form, like the longest form of writing, right?
Longest of forms. Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by like the kind of the multifaceted nature of video game writing, because you have to be able to write, things that work within the context of a game, obviously, but you also have to work with all these other people, mm-hmm, to develop the game and make it a functional thing. And I don't know, I find that stupidly interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. And the thing is, I really did find that I liked working with other people collaboratively.
Yeah.
But kind of in hindsight, I wonder, I did like, not in necessarily a bad way, but I did butt heads with the game game kind of director a few times, just because maybe that's why I was let go when COVID hit. But just when it came to basic story elements, I remember, and it could be in the game, I don't kind of want to mention it right now, but it could be in the game still, but he wanted to put an eternal day into the game, kind of to make it easier on the developers so they wouldn't have to do a whole day-night cycle.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I can work with this. It's like, so, you know, we have to change the flora, the fauna, we have to change a lot about it. And he's like, no, it's just going to be eternal day. And I'm like, well, no, because it would be like a desert planet. You don't have the same plants. You don't have taverns. You don't have nightlife. Like, you're not thinking this through. And so I just don't think they liked that sort of, maybe attention to detail. And to be looking back, I was like, maybe I was too, aggressive about it, and too, I stuck to my guns too much about it. Cause I was like, no, you just can't, it doesn't work.
Well, when I did like writing classes and stuff like that, I remember one of the, the advice that I got a lot was, try to make as much of the world, of your fantasy world, try to make it as much unique as you can. Mm-hmm. And, like Brandon Sanderson does this, obviously. Brandon's really known for this, where he'll totally change the flora and fauna of the world. And there's he alters things quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I've always stuck to a kind of a mentality of, if you change too much and your readers are going to have a much harder time getting into it. Mm-hmm. And so you need kind of the capital, like the fandom capital to be able to get away with that. You need to have the skill or the capital.
Yeah.
And somebody like Brandon clearly has both. Right.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think it's, I sometimes find myself overthinking those things of going down that domino train of, oh, okay, if you change this one thing, if you don't have a day-night cycle, then how does everything change? And you go down the dominoes and then you spend forever, world building, and you never actually get the stupid thing done, right?
Yeah. I'm also one of those people who, I've spent my entire life trying to get non-fantasy readers to read fantasy books.
Yeah.
And watch fantasy movies, everything like that. And so I know when I set out to write my, even Kings of the Wild, which is very unabashedly fantasy and contains every fantasy element I could possibly think of in there, but I didn't put them in there at the beginning. I wanted to make sure those first few chapters, you could kind of lure someone in before you hit them over the head with the fantasy hammer, as it were. I've got very short, easy to pronounce names. When a fantasy element is brought up, like someone mentions a Cyclops, and it's immediately almost made into a joke. And when it comes to using like monsters, although I do, put a bit of weird ones and made up some in there, I tried to use things like a goblin, because my mom, doesn't read books with goblins in it, but she knows what a goblin is. Basically she kind of gets it. Whereas if I had made up a creature and called it a Svigvart, or whatever, she'd read it and she'd bounce right off and go, no, I'm out. Where goblin is like, as long as she can see it and move on and the story keeps moving, it kind of works. And I think that happens for a lot of readers. And I think, keep trying to keep a few, like you said, just basic staples in there so that the rest of it, you can do whatever you want after that.
Well, and I think that I think you did it really well with Kings of the Wild, because you do have that kind of vibe of like a D&D campaign, right? Mm-hmm. Which is usually said in a criticizing way, but I am not meaning that way at all.
No, I don't take it that way.
Because the way that you have to, you almost kind of have to hang your hat on it, right? You have to say, this is an adventure novel. Literally, this is all adventure. And you're going full in on the fantasy elements and everything. But you did it with that whole kind of, with the whole rock star vibe, mm-hmm. which I think is what so many people really loved about it, was this, was being able to connect with that rock star vibe. And because of that vibe, you were able to much easier hang your hat on the fantasy elements.
Yeah, exactly.
And I really like that in terms of, because I sometimes myself, I am constantly on top of myself with my writing to remain grounded, mm-hmm. to a point at which maybe I stay too grounded, where I could go super weird in some places and then I don't. I like the way you kind of set up your world to give yourself permission to get as strange and as fun and out there as possible. And I really respect that as someone who struggles to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, different strokes for different folks. Like you know, sometimes people are in the mood for something a bit more grounded. Like, I personally like books that have Zwigvalds in them and weird names for goblins. You know, I'm into it because I'm a fantasy reader. So I certainly don't begrudge, you know, writers that do that. And reading your books, like, as a huge history buff, it feels like you're reading fantastical history sometimes, you know, where someone's not going to get that from mine. So, you know, having a vast array of stuff out there, but it just means that sometime in some other series, you can go full fantasy.
And, yeah.
You know, give yourself permission to let fly. It definitely is, like, it is nice having a world where I can use literally anything, you know.
I was curious about, because I know that you are also a huge fan of anime. Mm-hmm. And anime is one of those things that I personally have a very mixed relationship with.
There
are some anime that I find literally some of the best media out there, I think, is so cool. Yeah. Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood is like a masterpiece in my mind.
Truly, yeah.
But I feel like I don't have the patience or maybe the sense of humor or even maybe the cultural context for like 99% of anime. And I was curious, as someone who really loves anime, how you think that the kind of oddness that you find in that kind of TV, how does that affect what you're writing?
Well, I mean, the thing about, someone asked me once, you know, why I liked anime, and I'm just like, I think it, because it can be anything. Like, every show is so different from the another one, and even if they have the same theme, like, you know, person dies and gets taken to a fantasy world, once you're in there, every show is just so weird and different. And there's anime shows about everything. Like, the animes I love are, you know, there's ones that are like cooking, and the climaxes are like these cooking battles. And, you know, there are always things that before you told me before I got into it that I'd be into a cooking anime, I would never have believed you. But this one is just, it's just stupidly good. And I was riveted by it. Or a volleyball one with teenage, like, high school volleyball is like one of the best animes I've ever seen. Haiku. But I understand it is kind of a hard medium to get into, especially if someone's not familiar with it. And it's almost just like kind of like fantasy books itself. It's like if you're trying to get someone into it, you know, it's like if someone says, I'm trying to recommend fantasy books, and they just recommend the most fantasy of all books to a non-fantasy reader, you're just going to shoot yourself in the foot and turn them off. So with anime, you kind of got to look at the person and be like, okay, what do you like? And I also heard a funny saying once that each anime show has its own amount of anime, what's called anime bullshit, that you have to just suffer in order to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And like you said, once you watch more of it, there is like a sense of humor that's very specifically Japanese. It's you know, a little bit goofy. It's kind of very endearing. Very often it's perverted. And so you kind of have to just, you know, put up with it. Like every anime watcher and their dog is watching that show Chainsaw Man right now, which is like a huge show. And it's like, it's really good and it's beautifully animated and there's some really sentimental parts in it. But the main character is obsessed with touching a girl's chest. And both me and my brother are just like, oh, can this please stop? Can we get this arc moving so that he can stop being like this? But you just kind of got to put up with it if you're going to enjoy the rest of it.
Well, I'm kind of surprised that things that are have kind of gone mainstream still get away with that side of the skeeviness side of anime.
Yeah. And you're like, they're teenage, you know, it's a teenage boy. So you gotta, okay. You know, like, I guess I was a bit, you know, weird at that age too. But yeah, at the same time, ultimately there's just a lot of epic moments, and they've got a lot of the great animes have a ton of humor, a ton of like kind of sadness and just, yeah, epic scenes in them. So I think I kind of enjoy that. It's very, very inspiring to me when it comes to writing.
Hey, Page Break listeners, Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me. I like writing my action scenes as if they are playing as an anime in my head.
That's a great.
I have occasionally been accused, because this is one place where I don't ever stay grounded.
Yeah.
Is that I have occasionally been accused of my fight scenes not being realistic. And I mean, it's a fantasy novel, man. If I've got a guy carving through the middle of an army, it's not realistic. I want it to feel really epic in that way that because that is what does get me into like a really good anime, is with like an action anime, having those scenes, those fight scenes that feel very fluid and very like you just watch it and you're like, holy crap, that is cool.
Yeah.
I really do love that.
Yeah. And I think that that's something I really enjoy about your action scenes. And I can see that now that you say it. And I think that's part of like you said, like say I've built a world that I can get away with all kinds of like goofy fantasy stuff, but building a system, say like Brandon Sanderson has, where people can be doing like jumping off walls and running on ceilings. Like if you go to the trouble to build yourself that world, then you should get to enjoy the benefits of writing amazing, awesome scenes. And if you don't, then you get to write, you know, very realistic battle scenes where people are weighed down by their armor. You know, I always think of that. I've got a few friends that write, you know, like Christian Cameron, who writes very historical fantasy, you know, and his armor is always so realistic. People, you know, would take, no one just rolls across the tabletop in full plate, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas they do all the time in my work.
I definitely run into that. Like, this is like something I do when I'm drafting the first draft of most of my books, is that I will like start off trying to be more grounded, because it's my predilection. That's where I always kind of drift towards. And there will be a moment at which I finally say to myself, I just snap my fingers beside my head enough times and say, okay, Brian, I don't need to spend a half a page describing, you know, this guy's, you know, the weight of this guy's sword, right?
Yeah.
I can just have him be doing cool things. And you know what? Readers are going to like that. And honestly, I, as the writer, will enjoy writing it more than I would if I'm trying to be more realistic.
Yeah. If an author, like, once again, Christian Cameron, like, knows their stuff, then describing it comes so easily to them. Whereas people who don't know as much about it, like maybe you or I, we kind of struggle with it and maybe overdo it. You know, like when you find someone who doesn't know anything about ships trying to write a book that takes place on a ship, you're like, I get it. You researched ships.
I avoid ships so strongly with my books because, oh my gosh, that's just, it's like an alien world.
True.
When you start trying to research it a little bit, you're like,
yeah.
Oh, it's like there's a whole new language I have to learn. Like,
oh yeah, they are best avoided unless you really want to dig deep and go into it. Like obviously Scott Lynch with his second book, you know, like did a lot of research. You get it.
Yeah.
And it pays off when someone does. And then you get someone like RJ Barker who writes the Bone Ships. And he literally says, I think in an excerpt at the beginning of the book, I know nothing about ships. Don't come at me. And he just doesn't care, you know, and just makes it up. And his ships are made of like dragon bones. So you kind of get away with stuff like that.
Right. And there is kind of like a thing where you have to come up with some sort of acknowledgement to yourself to be able to realize, look, there are places where I am not an expert or I'm not good at something. And I don't have to be. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not my job to be. And if I want to write something that's set on a ship and I don't know all the vocabulary, then oh well.
Yeah.
And if you as the author are okay with that and you have sort of a there's almost like a narrative presence, that if you have the proper narrative presence where you're not quite winking at the audience.
Yeah.
You're like just coming shy of winking at the audience. There's this narrative presence that allows you to get away with lots of stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't even know how to describe that or how I would even coach someone in creating something like that. But it's totally a thing, though, that if you get across the right sort of sense of humor or something to your audience, you can get away with not knowing jack shit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think every fantasy reader or writer, when they're writing their world, talking about like a journey, they think, oh, someone's going to someone's going to, you know, look at my map if I make a map and go, oh, they took this long to get this place. I remember I was so reluctant to make a map for my book. And I love maps. I drew maps all the time. I love when a fantasy book has maps, but I was like, please don't make me do a map because I was just winging it. 1,000 miles across this forest. I have no idea how, you know, I was just making it up. And so they made me do a map and it worked out, you know, fine in the end, but no one really calls you on it. Like ultimately, especially readers nowadays, you know, with the kind of media that everyone consumes, I just don't think they care as much anymore. They just want to have fun and enjoy it. And so when it comes to something like distances or like, how does this work exactly? As long as it's cool, I think you can get away with a lot.
I'm working on my 8th epic fantasy and I am still way too obsessed with geographic precision.
Yeah.
Like it drives me up the wall.
Yeah.
And I'll agonize over my own maps saying, okay,
yeah.
So if this is roughly this many miles, that'll take 5 days or so to get between those things. So I need to have a 5-day gap between these two scenes. And the fact is that I, like you said, I really don't need to.
Yeah.
Like I need to have it feel kind of right for the audience, but it doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
But me as an author, you know, that's one of those weird things that really gets under my skin. And it doesn't when I'm reading, just when I'm writing.
Yeah, I do the same thing. And it's kind of like once you, with the first book of a series, you know, saying this to someone who only has one series, you can wing it because you don't have a map yet or no one's seen it. But yeah, it's once that first book comes out, then you're stuck. Then you got to start looking at your map, you know, and start. Yeah, I definitely had to do that with my second book. I was like, okay, how long is it going to take to get to here? Which is actually another great reason why I have like skyships, airships in my book, because I can just use them to, if I need to get somewhere fast, just bam, skyship.
Yeah, there, that works.
You know, I don't even need to research how long a horse takes because I just made these ships up. So, and some of them go different speeds. So no one can be like, well, you know, a horse only trots this far in a day, you know? So
Right. And it is funny because readers don't notice until they do, you know, it's the thing of, it's the thing with, like, and I'm referencing the TV show because we have it, you know, ostensibly completed. But it's the Game of Thrones thing where there was so much work put in at the very beginning to talk about vast distances.
Yeah.
And then in the final season, everybody's just teleporting back and forth across those spaces. And suddenly the watcher, the viewer knew what was going on, suddenly said, oh, wait a second, they shouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah.
And it's when you put so much work into something at the very beginning, but then throw that all out later, that's when you kind of screw yourself.
You know, they definitely flush it down the toilet. Yeah. It's like, we're north of the wall, we're south of the wall, we're in King's Landing. Whereas in the first season, it's like 2-episode journey to King's Landing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
And it is funny, though, because as you work through, a series and you are trying to focus on different things as you move through subsequent books, suddenly the thing that you thought was incredibly important that you get across to the reader in the first book, suddenly it doesn't seem that important to you anymore.
Yeah.
Like your priorities as a writer change as you go along. I mean, like, have you found that?
Well, my books all kind of have different timelines as well. So, you know, there's like a 6-year gap between the first and second and a 14-year gap between the second and third. So I almost feel as if I have to kind of reestablish the rules every time I start again, just because the world has changed relatively drastically in between each of these books. So yeah, I feel like I'm starting a whole new series each book.
That's actually really interesting because I do the opposite. My books, because I've so far, you know, I'm halfway through, almost halfway through my third trilogy. And I've always regarded my trilogies, at least, as single books, you know.
Yeah.
Just really big books divided into three spots. And so they move continuously from the end of book one to book two, you know, like that. And every time I start a new book, I think to myself, well, maybe I should do a time jump. Maybe, you know, I can fiddle with some things. Maybe I should change things up. And then I always end up landing on, no, let's go almost immediately from the end of the last book.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you ever agonize over that, or if that's something that you feels very natural to have, like a long time jump and to kind of reset the world almost.
Well, it is for these books in particular, only because they're each kind of inspired by a separate era of music. So with my first book being kind of 70s, like rock and folk music, and the second book being kind of the 80s, you know, pop, punk, metal, that kind of stuff. And then the third book moves into the 90s. So it's very kind of based on like grunge and hip hop and that kind of music. And not only the music itself, but the where the music was coming from. So like in the 70s, kind of like in the first book, there's a sense of like wonderment and adventure and rambling. Like, you know, they had these 17-minute songs that you would never have nowadays, you know, or at least on the commercial music. And although they, you know, these bands were getting big, they were just getting big. Like they had come from very small things, like small beginnings, and had no clue that they were going to get so huge. And then with the second book, kind of like the 80s, these bands, they knew there was a formula to get huge. And they mimicked what came before, but did it bigger, louder, brasher, painted their faces, screamed, spiked their hair, colored their hair, did all that kind of stuff. Did crazy drugs, you know, did the stuff you hear these legendary stories about, like, you know, the drummer from Led Zeppelin or somewhere driving his motorcycle through a hotel. So they'd be like, I'm going to do that every night. And so that kind of thing, that kind of attitude and outlook inspires the story itself, and also just the kind of setting that the world is in. And then moving into the 90s, the music that I'm looking at, like grunge, like hip hop, was made by people that were kind of like pissed off, like Rage Against the Machine, like with the establishment or with their, you know, how they were living and treated by society. So you've got to make a society that reflects that, and that tone works in. So yeah, that has kind of made each book's tone quite a bit different, and necessitates the time jump, I think.
Yeah. That's really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the end, I think the world, I mean, at least my plan is to have the world go through an arc like a character would, and to see a world, how it would change over the course of two or three decades and generations. You know?
Yeah. I really like that. I think that's quite a neat kind of approach. Like I had mentioned already before, it was that kind of the kind of rock and roll vibe that you give your books, that kind of the basis in music. It's, you know, we, you know, when we write, and we've alluded to this already, but when we write, we have to write these fantasy worlds with a way for the reader, like a hook for the reader to feel like it's not totally alien. Mm-hmm. Like they want to recognize something in that world, even if it's a super fantasy world. And I like that the kind of the rock and roll kind of aspect that you're dealing with, that gives a hook that isn't actually like it's stated, but not stated. Like,
true. Yeah. It goes right over some people's heads, believe it or not.
Right. It's
and bludgeons other people over the head.
Right. And it's a little more, I think it's a little bit more subtle. It's a little more thematic than it is like a solid part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I really like that as a way to hook the reader and bring them in and give them something to hang on to that they recognize while they're going on this crazy journey.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously it has been referred to before by agents, you know, I submitted to as like a gimmick, because it kind of is, you know, but at the same time, I really think it works really well within the context of a fantasy world. Like, you know, mercenary bands getting paid to fight monsters. Why wouldn't you be famous? You'd be so famous if you did that. And why wouldn't you get a manager to organize these, you know, things for you, and rather than do it yourself? So, and then why wouldn't, when, you know, when you'd cleared out all the goblin caves and saved all the towns and things were getting like short and glory was in short supply, why wouldn't you just, oh, we'll just make arenas? Like, why would we go into this poison monster infested forest? We could just tour from town to town, sleep in an awesome inn, throw a party, go to the arena, fight the monsters, be famous. So I feel like it's a pretty good evolution. And I think with the third book, you know, it kind of moves on like how that would concept evolves. I think it works really well within the context of a fantasy world. So although it did 100% begin as a gimmick, it's definitely evolved into something I think works pretty cohesively as a, you know, fantasy world structure.
Well, and it's funny because gimmick is, you know, it's a word that, you know, has negative connotations, but mm-hmm. but you have to have a selling point when you're taking a book to an agent or an editor.
Yeah.
Like you have to have something, you have to have a hook for them.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have the hook that brings the reader along for the ride, but you also have to have the really easy two sentence elevator pitch that mm-hmm. that the person that's going to pay you for the book hears that and says, oh yeah, I can get behind that.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, both of us really, in a way, like there wasn't really, I don't think, something quite like maybe Kings of the Wild when it came, like obviously like rock and roll fantasy to me hadn't really existed before. And I'm sure when you went, you were like Flintlock Fantasy. They're like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and if I want to say now it seems so commonplace, but it really isn't, because there's like not that many people that do it. And yet it's just so, it's such a ripe genre.
Yeah.
And you were like a pioneer of that.
Well, and that's a weird thing. Like I have this, like, I have a very strange like thing where I'm, God, it would be super like, it'd be super arrogant for me to say like I'm king of a subgenre or something like that. But there is like a way, there is like a small way in which I am like, I'm at the front of the wave for a small subgenre in epic fantasy. And
I think if anyone writing Flintlock Fantasy in the future has to, would have to admit that, and I don't want to like float your boat too much here, but like that you kicked open the door for Flintlock Fantasy. You definitely did. You and Django Wexler, like for sure did it.
Right. But I mean, there were people that also came out after me, like Django. Django came out just a few months after me, and and we had never heard of each other. We didn't collaborate. Yeah. We both had vaguely similar ideas for a pitch for A Cool World at the same time. And then more people did the same similar kind of, they kind of clung on to that vague, like, you know, subgenre.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it is kind of cool to be kind of like at the forefront of that, you know, like, but also it gives you kind of this like weird, like old man feel now that I've been in there for 10 years where I'm when in my day, when I was writing the fantasies, I definitely get a little bit of that in the back of my brain.
Well, as I think you've earned it. Yeah.
I don't know about that.
I mean, and to me, I didn't think, I mean, funnily enough, I hadn't read Terry Pratchett before I wrote my book. I've read tons of them now. And granted, you can't even say Terry Pratchett's necessarily humorous fantasy, because although it is, he's pretty much his own genre. Like there's nobody that writes like him, period. But as far as like fantasy that really tried to be funny,
yeah,
I didn't actually know any that existed. I knew that Scott Lynch had made me laugh and Joe Abercrombie made me laugh, but I knew that in every other book, when the characters tells a joke and everyone's laughing, I'm just like straight face going, okay, that was a joke. Sure.
Right.
I'll trust you, I guess. But I'd never really laughed out loud at books until those authors. I definitely felt that I was kind of taking a risk writing a book that was so, that tried to be funny, whether it's funny or not. Obviously, everyone's has a different opinion. But I think I got kind of pushback when I was trying to get published, to tone it down, to make it like a Abercrombie light, you know? And thankfully I got, you know, an editor and agent that let me do it.
Well, and that doesn't surprise me at all. You know, when I was in school, when I was taking classes that focused on fantasy and science fiction, one of the things they told you was there are a couple of people who have successfully done comedy, sci-fi, and fantasy. Mm-hmm. And if you're not one of those people, don't do it.
Yeah.
It's never going to work.
Yeah.
And they were very blunt about that. Yeah. Just like, you know, agents don't want it. Editors don't want it. And so it is like you should feel really good about the fact that you were able to push that through, you know, not just through an agent and an editor, but actually to acquire an audience, because comedy is one of those really weird spaces where it's so subjective that it's hard to land on a broader audience.
Totally.
For something like what you do with this adventure fantasy as the backdrop.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of people out there that call it, you know, you'll get the comments that say that it's like 14-year-old boy humor, which is fair, but it's also 40-year-old boy humor. and so, yeah, I mean, obviously it's, I do feel really lucky. I think the audience actually was there. Who knows? There was books before mine that started out funnier and got, you know, pared down. Because to be honest, like I say, I was lucky enough to have two offers at the same time. And one of them was keep it as it is. And one of them was change it. And thankfully, but if the one that said change it came in, I probably would have taken it, because I've been trying to be a writer for like 20 years. So, you know, I would have jumped at that, and it would have been a vastly different book, and very, very likely would have been lost amidst the sea of other books just like it. So I feel fortunate that I found that my editor and agent were, you know, saw something in it that, you know, just took a chance for sure. I think took a chance and it worked out.
Yeah. And that's something that's one of those kind of rough spaces with, with talking about agents and editors, because we can talk all we want about the fact that there are probably lots of books that get missed. Like you mentioned, maybe there were lots of funny things that ended up getting pared down or didn't find success and things like that.
Yeah.
But I do always try to remember that like agents and editors are just people trying to do a job, like almost with a Ouija board, like 100%. Figuring out what a broad audience will actually enjoy. How do you do that?
Yeah. And they've got, and publishing gets accused of saying like trying to repeat successes, but you've got to, like you want to, and same with an author tries to repeat success as well.
Oh yeah.
You try to make your second book like your first book. You try to make your second series appeal to the people who liked your first. So you definitely can't blame them for not wanting to take crazy risks, especially, in publishing's precarious situation these days. So yeah, I absolutely, cannot blame anyone for any of the choices they make ultimately.
I saw a review for my latest book, In the Shadow of Lightning, and it's a whole new series. And I saw a review that was basically like, this felt a little too much like Powder Mage. And in my brain, I just went, yeah, man, I've got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah,
like, exactly. Of course it feels a bit like Powder Mage.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got an idea for my next series, and guess what? It's going to feel a little bit like Kings of the Wild. It's going to be, quite a bit different, but it's going to just because, A, that's your voice, that you find your voice and you want to work within it and you found success within it. And then B, you want to make the people that have supported you thus far happy,
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I've talked to some writers who jump around a lot. My good friend Dan Wells, like no two of his books are the same. He loves jumping genres. He loves changing things up constantly. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of respect for that. But I also feel like I feel like the anxiety it would cause me trying to jump to a new audience every single time.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, that would kill me.
Yeah, I think it just depends on, I'm guessing, you and I are both relatively slow writers. One of us is a lot slower than the other. But, if you're a fast writer, I think you've got a bit more leeway there because you can throw more stuff at the wall and see what sticks and see what you like. And if something fails, you're already two books written. You've already got two more books written, ready to go. So,
yeah.
You can just try something else. Whereas, with the length I write, it's like I better write something that appeals to my readers because,
Right, because that took me a year and a half or whatever. Like it's a lot of time you put into a book.
Yeah.
Now, so are you a full time author now?
Yes.
How long have you been going full time?
Slash video game player.
Oh man, that is too true. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Slash stare outer of windows and cat feeder. No, I was fortunate enough. I it took me a while. Like I didn't have a big advance and. But Kings of the Wild did pretty good right out of the gate. I would say it took me about a little over 2 years after Kings of the Wild before I was able to go full time.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in restaurants all the time while I was writing my book and worked in restaurants right up until Buddy Rose was out.
When you say worked in restaurants, what did you do?
I was a server.
Yeah?
Yeah, serving tables. And to be honest, I really, really miss it.
Really?
A lot. Oh, yeah. I just loved it. I thought it is the perfect job for someone who... has other stuff going on, like obviously like actors are famously a lot of servers, but just because it's so flexible, you work so little hours for so much money comparatively, what other people work and how much other money other people make. It's just a great job. And to someone who, maybe it's just because I've gotten older and because I've spent more time writing that I'm more of an introvert now, but it made me, you go out and you have to be on every single day, and I do, like, I'm a relatively social person, but it was a great way to stay social. And just in general, I was one of those freaks that didn't really care about how much money I made all the time.
Yeah.
I loved giving people incredible nights. And thankfully I worked at some restaurants that allowed me to do that. And I loved it and I miss it. I go out to dine like all the time. So I still get it, but I can be a little, it's like, oh, this is taking a long time to come. So I can be a little nitpicky, but also forgiving.
Right. Now I do wonder that. Cause I've worked some crap jobs, but I've never done wait staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious how that changes your perspective towards going out to eat at any number of different types of restaurants, right? Like, where do you find yourself picking apart the person that's bringing you food, or do you find yourself kind of a little bit more relaxed and kind of like, oh yeah, this guy, they'll get it out. They're doing their job. I let them do their job.
That's an excellent question. I think I'm I like to think I'm on the like more forgiving side of it, because I mean, just in general and everything in life, whether it's a video game or a TV show, I want to like it. A dining experience, a book, I want to like it. And I will make excuses for it for quite some time before I'm like, okay, this is not good. Let's call it Wheel of Time syndrome. Wheel of Time TV show syndrome. But going out, I tend to have really good times. And unless something like, the only thing that really like pisses me off is like, extremely long waits between things. And then the server kind of showing up and being like, hey, like, and acting as if you're not sitting there beside a skeleton that used to be your girlfriend, you know?
Yeah.
But otherwise, I like when you read a book and you're like, you know, say if you find a spelling mistake and you go, as a writer, you're like, well, I know how these can be missed, you know, by so many people. And the same thing goes for in a restaurant. If someone's like, something's taking a long time, I can look around and be like, oh, well, it's because they just got triple sat with this many people and everyone's ordering drinks at the same time. And, you know, so I can, yeah, usually kind of break things down and know why things are happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I find when I know how the sausage is made in a particular profession, I find that I am much more forgiving about it because I know the points of failure, right? Like I know what can be the person's fault that's standing in front of me,
yeah.
But also what can be the fault of people that I don't even see.
Yeah.
And so that you're kind of able to, like you said, you make excuses. You kind of like, you're more forgiving and you're kind of like, as long as you're not having a horrible day yourself already, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, and there's a server here in town where I live, and I've had him a couple times at this restaurant. He's like, he is not great at his job, but he's so enthusiastic and so endearing, and he's trying so goddamn hard that he is getting 20% every time. Like, it doesn't matter that he sucks at it because he's trying hard, and that's ultimately what really matters, like to me at least. You know?
Yeah, I definitely, definitely, if I like someone, like I will forgive them so many things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and it doesn't even have to be like them on an intellectual level. You know, if they've got a ready smile, you know, if they look me in the eye, if they're apologetic, there's like, and that applies not just to like going to a restaurant, but just in life in general. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's so many things that a person can do that makes them really easy to forgive for most everything.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's when it comes to like, you know, talking about that in a writing context too, it's like, if I know more, the more I know about an author, very often, the more I'll enjoy their books because, you know, you just kind of see their perspective on things and you enjoy it. Like I love reading my friends' books just because you feel like you're spending time with them in some small way, or even authors I've never met. You know, if you listen to them on your podcast, for instance, like it just gives you so much insight. Like I've never met Pierce Brown, but my God, I feel a deep kinship with him because we like almost the same things, you know. We're pretty much twins, obviously. Just except for his full head of hair and ruggish good looks. But you know, besides that, yeah. So I do like knowing more about an author, and yeah, I find it, you know, you enjoy their art more, to me at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, it is interesting because I do run into some people that kind of have that that belief in kind of the death of the author, right? Like you ignore that person, mm-hmm. and you ignore the fact they exist completely. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't think about their politics or their habits or their likes or dislikes. But I don't know. I've always kind of erred on that side of I kind of want to know about this person. And if I find out that they are a scumbag, I probably will enjoy what they do less.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, there's like this school of thought. My wife and I talk about this a lot. There's this school of thought that is almost like you had to create really deep art. You kind of have to be this horrible, tortured person. And I super don't believe in that.
No, definitely me neither.
Like life experience is definitely important. Like very much so.
Yeah, no, but I know what you mean. It's like, say, if you have kids, you're going to bring a different perspective to everything that you write. And you could definitely say it's going to make you better at, say, I don't know, writing those kind of scenes or writing from that kind of perspective. I sure don't want kids, so no thank you. But, you know, it just depends on, yeah, ultimately everything that happens to you in life will.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, like, I guess my thought is that art isn't an excuse to be a douchebag, right? Like, it's not an excuse to to treat people poorly,
yeah,
or, you know, lash out or do huge amounts of drugs or whatever it is your poison is, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, some people see it as an excuse, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, I mean, I've met all kinds of authors, obviously, but the ones that I at least would try to emulate the most are there's so many authors out there, like Kevin Hearn, Robin Hobb, you know, who just have these, they're not like, they're not angsty, they're not anxious, they got none of, you know, they're not like on Twitter bemoaning anything.
Yeah.
They just enjoy their life. And
yeah.
And I think you can kind of see that reflected in their work. And it's not always to say it's better than someone who's not enjoying their life, but, you know, it's possible, obviously, to be just an absolute gem of a human being and write what Robin Hobb writes. Yeah.
Right. Well, and Robin, you know, we all follow her on Twitter, and she's so delightful.
Yeah.
She's just like the nicest. She's like Epic Fantasy's grandma. And she writes and she tends to her farm.
Yeah.
And she's just super great. Like that's like definitely, you know, she writes interesting, deep, crazy things, sometimes very dark things.
Yeah.
But also she, you know, feeds the geese. You know, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. Thankfully, writing is different than, say, rock and roll that way, where a lot of, you know, people in rock and roll music felt they had to obliterate themselves in order to, you know, create art.
I watched, a few years back, I watched this Tom Petty documentary. I just forgot the name of it, but it's like 4 hours long.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I think it might be Running Down a Dream. But the thing that I came away from that with was this realization that some of these, even these incredibly world famous rock stars, are really just normal people who happened to get big. Mm-hmm. And Tom Petty very much comes across from that.
Yeah.
Because he is very clearly a genius and very clearly a professional, like good at what he does,
yeah,
on like a really deep level. But he also, like, he was a guy who just, he wanted to make music and he wanted his friends to make music. And I thought that that's just so dang cool. I highly recommend that documentary.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I mean, yeah, I mean, ultimately music today, obviously there's a lot more manufactured stuff. So it's not always the case, but there are obviously definitely artists that start, you know, very small and get really huge. I think back then in Tom Petty's day and age, there wasn't too much precedent for huge. Like there was the Beatles and Elvis. So yeah, pretty much everyone, like someone like the Rolling Stones, you know, and when I was doing research for Kings of the Wild, I read a lot of these biographies, and they were those their first albums, they were making them in like empty houses so that the drums would reverberate a certain way, and like very, you know, had they had to be really like do this rudimentary sound engineering that these days you just wouldn't do. You just,
yeah,
you know, do it in the studio. So yeah, they definitely had to like, yeah, start from the grassroots kind of way. And yeah, there's something really cool about that.
Did you watch that massive Beatles documentary that came out?
No, I don't think I didn't.
It's like 8 hours long. It's like a big thing. It was all restored by, yeah, Peter Jackson, I think.
Yes, I remember it was pretty big.
Yeah, but that one was interesting. I really liked it. And part of what I really liked about it was the fact that you had these guys that were, it was their final album. They were the biggest rock stars in the world. And they were still talking about like trying to make sounds like you were mentioning, like,
yeah,
like echoing various things. Like they're like moving around equipment. They're banging on walls. They're like just making this shit up. and they're the biggest people in the world, right? And I absolutely love that.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Maybe I'll check it out one of these days.
There's a humanizing element to seeing how that kind of thing is done, even at the very highest levels, that I really love. So I've been keeping you for quite a long time, and I like to finish up every one of these episodes by asking a question to everyone, which is, what's the last thing that you ate that blew your mind?
Well, as you know, I'm a longtime Page Break listener, so I was ready for this answer. And I'm actually going to go pretty far back for this one, only because, like I said, I do eat out quite a bit. There's been a lot of amazing meals, but if we're talking mind-blowing, you and I share a Spanish publisher, I believe.
Ooh, probably.
In Gamon. Yeah. And I was fortunate enough to get to go there last November for the 42 Festival. And when we were there, my girlfriend and I just kind of wandered around Barcelona and found a hole in the wall restaurant and ate a very typically European meal, and that it took 3.5 hours to, get through everything. Really took our time, drank a lot of wine. And at the end, we ordered a tiramisu. And I've always been I love chocolate. I love coffee too, but I love chocolate. There's a chocolate cake. I'm ordering that. And I was just so about tiramisu. And we tried this tiramisu, and it was the best thing I've ever tasted in my whole life.
Oh.
And I was like, this is the pinnacle. I didn't realize that tiramisu was the pinnacle of all food. And I will probably spend the rest of my life chasing that exact taste, because I've had, 8 since then, and none have come quite close to it. So a tiramisu in a hole-in-the-wall restaurant in Barcelona was the last thing that blew my mind.
Ah, that sounds awesome. When you, I don't know, I think I've reached a point, because when you're younger and you start learning about fancy desserts, everything's kind of exciting and holy crap, this is going to be amazing. But I feel like I reached the point right around when I hit 30, mm-hmm. where desserts, even when I got a really fancy one, they all tended to taste kind of the same. And so when I get something that's truly unique, that elevates what I'm eating, oh my gosh, an elevated dessert is just, it imprints itself on your brain.
And boy, did this ever. I go to a lot of restaurants. I make a lot of food too. And just that one was mind blowing. It was so good.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, I really love that. That was author Nicholas Eames. Thanks again to Nick for coming on to chat. You can find links to Nick's social media down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. As a quick reminder, jump onto the Kickstarter to support my new Glass Immortals novella. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to subscribe, and leave a review. If you're listening to this via Patreon, please stick around for a bonus chat during the epilogue. Special thanks to Elijah, Ivor Gullickson, James Clark, Jennifer Johnson, Jay Sunnell, Kyle Anderson, Sexton Hardcastle, and Talon for their backing on Patreon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.